Coming up on Weekend America.
When the Democrats didn't want Mike Gravel as their nominee, he stepped away quietly, right?
No, I just went down to the office of the Libertarian Party, and I said, how do I join the Libertarian Party? And they were so delighted. I'm probably the biggest fish they ever caught.
It's another weekend of campaigning from behind. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. On this first weekend of Passover, we'll meet the Hebrew Israelites of Chicago.
My grandmother always told us that we were the people that came out of Egypt.
We'll visit the African-American synagogue of Temple Beth Shalom. And you know you're in for a memorable weekend when it starts with these words.
It's important to me that everybody that came with hair and eyebrows leaves with the same amount of hair and eyebrows.
Step up, pay your money, and set fire to Kansas on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to the weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. What a weekend! Earth Day events, Passover Seders, and the annual Grilled Cheese Invitational. We're going to get to them all, but for now we only have time to ask you about one. So, how do you do a great grilled cheese?
I'll tell you the secret to grilled cheese sandwiches. Rosemary.
I use a hamburger bun and usually one slice of American cheese and one slice of pepper jack cheese.
Okay, this is very special. You need the right bread, and it's a 9-grain bread that I use. And then on the inside, you put a thin coat of cream cheese.
And then I use an iron, like a clothes iron, because I don't like to dirty dishes and stuff, and it works just the same. And then you just put the bread with some butter and cheese on the iron, and it melts it right away.
Wow. He prefers greasy irons to dirty dishes?
Apparently. Those voices came to us from Los Angeles, Brooklyn, and Iowa City.
Well, this weekend, all eyes are on Pennsylvania. The Keystone State is gearing up for its presidential primary Tuesday. Will Clinton score a decisive victory, or will Obama keep it close, maybe even pull an upset? Well, we'd like to remind you that there's more to this presidential campaign than the Liberty Bell showdown. Weekend America's John Moe has been bringing us a series of stories called I'm Also Running for President. He's spotlighting candidates who don't often get the spotlight. This week, we catch up with Mike Gravel. At the beginning of this race, Gravel was running as a Democrat. Well, he's not a Democrat anymore, but he is still running.
Mike Gravel is a former 2-term senator from Alaska. He had been out of politics since 1980, but he earned his place in the early debates alongside Obama, Clinton, and the rest. That gave him an audience to talk to about his one big audacious idea, the National Initiative. Gravel thinks the American people should vote on new laws.
I'm saying that it's important to empower the American people so that they can get control of their government. I mean, I'm trying to change the paradigm of human governance.
It's an idea that consumes Gravel. The future of America depends on it. But neither the initiative nor Gravel really caught on. Now, normally when candidates realize it's just not happening, they give a little speech, smile and act nice, and vanish from public view. Not Gravel.
And so the Democrats get into cahoots with General Electric, and they cut me out of the debates, and the rest of the networks follow suit. And so I might as well just leave the party and go where I belong.
The Democrats were done with Gravel, but Gravel wanted to keep going. So he quit the party that had been his home his entire career. And he called up the Libertarians, one of the biggest third-party groups. The Libertarians had not yet picked a nominee.
I just went down to the office of the Libertarian Party, and I said, look it, how do I join the Libertarian Party? And they were so delighted. They were ecstatic to have me join. I'm probably the biggest fish they ever caught.
Shane Corey is the executive director of the party. He remembers the meeting.
It was in the afternoon around 2 or 3 o'clock. I don't know the exact date. It was a couple weeks ago. He walked in the door fully knowing and wanting to become a member of the Libertarian Party.
But Democrats and Libertarians are pretty different beasts. One calls for an active role for government in people's lives. The other wants as little government as possible.
Libertarians can be very protective. I'll be the first to admit that. Protective of our platform, protective about our ideas. And he's been warmly received. Now, people may have disagreements on his issues.
Oh, yeah, issues. Gravel wants to replace the income tax with a so-called fair tax.
Replacing a tax is just not palatable to most libertarians.
That's Libertarian presidential candidate Mary Ruart. She's one of Gravel's rivals for the nomination. She's met Gravel, likes him, she just doesn't think he's a libertarian.
Mike Gravel is also for the carbon tax, which libertarians are not for. He has advocated universal health care, which libertarians are not for.
Ruart has been a Libertarian Party member for 30 years. She's running for president to promote the cause.
I can support our state and local candidates by bringing in more people into the party and more voters to vote for our lower echelon candidates.
So it's more about stumping for county commissioners and city council members and growing the party. Gravel is in it for himself, to promote his idea, and the libertarians know that. But still, this is a presidential campaign. Isn't the point to actually get elected president?
Well, I have to admit, the chance is probably pretty small.
We're under no delusion that we're going to win the White House.
Just don't tell that to Mike Gravel. I mean, seriously, don't. It gets pretty uncomfortable.
Wait a second. Where do you come off saying that? Please, why would you say that? Wait a second. If you're an observer of politics, as I'm sure you are, and I am too, and I've been at it since I was 15, anything is possible in politics. So let's not start by saying that they won't have it. Here, I think I've got a good chance.
Okay, suppose it works. Suppose after all this, he gets elected. He would still have to somehow implement this plan, this national initiative that he's been fighting like crazy for, that he left his party for. Gravel has that all figured out.
I will spend the first 6 months of my presidency going around the country to bully the American people to vote for the national initiative. And if they don't vote to empower themselves as lawmakers and share power with me, I will quit. I don't want to be their leader.
Okay, then. I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
The Libertarian Party will choose their nominee at a convention in Denver next month. We have more information on Gravel and the Libertarians at our website. We also have some videos Mike Gravel starred in last year, including one called Rock. I'd nominate it for one of the strangest, most intriguing pieces of performance art ever to feature a presidential candidate in a starring role. Check it all out, weekinamerica.org.
This weekend, the weather in South Texas will be sunny. Residents will have a clear view across the Rio Grande into Mexico. That could soon change. In 2006, Congress decided to put 700 miles of fence, some call it a wall, along the U.S. border from California to Texas. Last year, Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff scaled that back to 370 miles. Which means the fence will not be continuous. It'll have to stop and start. So what determines where it stops and where it picks up again? The government hasn't said, but this fence is slated to go right through the properties of many lower and middle class Texas residents and not through the properties of some very wealthy Texans. One of the people who does stand to be walled off from some of her land is Eloisa Tamez. She lives in El Calabos near Brownsville. She's trying to stop Homeland Security from dividing the 3 acres behind her house just north of the Rio Grande. Welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with some history, Eloisa. How did your family end up on the U.S.-Mexican border?
This land on which I'm sitting now is part of the land grant that was given to my ancestors back in 1767. That was a land grant from the King of Spain. And it was, at that time, that territory there was Mexico. Our ancestors have been in that territory long before Texas was a republic, long before Texas became a state. So we're pretty much an indigenous group of that region.
And tell us about this region. What is life like today in El Calabos?
In El Calabos, many of the peoples, and I have many relatives who have adjoining tracts to mine, many of them are still working the land pretty much the same way that it was worked years back. They raise crops, corn, cabbage, but it's almost all according to the season, because the land is very fertile. It's, you know, by the river's edge, so the land is very fertile. You can grow just about anything. The other thing, too, is that they raise cows and chickens and hogs and sheep and goats, and, you know, they just do whatever they can to make enough money to pay their taxes and so on.
What would it be like for you to have this 18-foot border wall come through your land?
Well, it's going to be very interesting, because it's not just the wall that's going to go up, but there's going to be highways. There's going to be a lot of lights. As the Border Patrol put it to me the first time they approached me, that they're going to build a gate about 3 or 4 miles east of where my property is, whereby those of us who have land on the other side would be able to access it. One of the things I brought up to them, I said, but is it just going to be a gate where we can go through and from without any problem? And they said, no, well, you will have to show identification. I said, well, then it's a checkpoint. And so I'm going to have to go through a checkpoint to and from when I want to go see the other side of my land.
Eloisa, Homeland Security says this wall is important for our security and that some Americans will have to make a sacrifice. The taking of lands for national purposes has been going on a long time. Why are you fighting this?
I'm not saying that I myself am going to stop the construction of this wall. The government is much too powerful, as we see every day. And when I brought the opposition to Homeland Security, it was not about my wanting to stop the building of the wall. I cannot do it as one individual, stop that power. My litigation was to say to the government, I, as an individual, had a legal right to be able to fight for my land. And so I know that some people say, well, you know, why would she be fighting for 3 acres? Well, it's not just the 3 acres. It's what it represents. I mean, that's the way we see it at our end.
Your ancestors' connection to this land goes back more than 200 years. What do you imagine when you think 200 and 300 years forward for what this wall might mean to the land and your family?
Well, it's going to be gone. It's the whole, not only will the wildlife be destroyed, but also the indigenous peoples and the cultures of this international boundary zone will be extinguished. It will no longer be the same. Are we going to be proud to say that we have built the eighth wonder of the world and it's all in South Texas? Is that what our legacy is going to be?
Eloisa, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
We invited Homeland Security's Office of Customs and Border Protection to comment for this story. They haven't yet returned our calls. The department has not publicly explained the criteria it uses to decide what parts of the fence go where. The Texas Observer magazine first reported where the border fence will and will not go in the Brownsville area. You can read that full article at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now wherever books are sold.
A black congregation in Chicago embraces its African roots in Judaism. Coming up on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, thanks for sharing your weekend with us. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. This weekend is Passover, a holiday where Jews commemorate their escape from Egypt. Many Jews use the holiday to reflect on the various forms of bondage and the meaning of freedom. One synagogue in Chicago doesn't have to go so far back into time to find an apt parable. Independent producer Eric Malinsky recently spent the weekend at Chicago's Temple Beth Shalom.
Temple Beth Shalom was built over 60 years ago, when the south side of Chicago was full of Eastern European Jews. The synagogue is still here, but the congregation has changed. Today, the members are mostly black. They call themselves Hebrew Israelites. They stand in their seats clapping and singing. Many wear dashikis, or tailored black robes. The men wear large African skull caps with Jewish iconography woven into the patterns.
My grandmother always told us that we were the people that came out of Egypt. We were the people that came out of Egypt. We were the people that came out of Egypt.
Tammy McCullough has been here since she was a kid. She identifies with the ancient Israelites because they were dark-skinned and they were slaves.
We don't forget that we came from Mississippi, we're descendants of slaves, and we came through a lot. We went through a lot to get here as a people. We bring that spirit with us in the music, in the teaching, in the speaking. We are passionate people because at one point that's all we had was our passion and our music. That's all we had.
The Hebrew Israelite movement started in the early 1900s, around the same time as the Nation of Islam. They both appealed to African Americans who were seeking a new identity beyond the black church. But that's where the similarities end. Rabbi Capers Fineh conducted the six-hour Saturday service. There was much bowing and praying in Hebrew. Rabbi Fineh wore a suit and tie and a small, round yarmulke. He gave a sermon about the environment using biblical interpretation.
It descends and then it begins to permeate everything that exists on earth. And it then goes into the sea. It goes into the snow. It goes into the rain. It goes into the rocks.
Rabbi Fineh learned to walk that line between politics and practice, faith and identity. He was born a Christian and grew up in the South during the Jim Crow era. In his mind, he couldn't separate Christianity from the politics of segregation.
The people that are telling you you're not qualified to come here look like the same people in the book that they're telling you the people that are going to save you.
He was working as an accountant when he went through a spiritual crisis. He looked at Islam for a while, and then he got around to exploring Judaism. One day he asked a white rabbi,
"Where is the African's place in the biblical story?" And he said, "Certainly, you know, black people are part of the story." And then he went on and started doing some delineation. Then he said, "Well, you know, many of the first Jews were, in fact, people of African descent." I said, "Uh-huh. Okay, that's trying to make some sense. Okay, now we can talk more."
There are different streams of Judaism, from the Hasidic to the Sephardic. He studied them all. He picked the practices that made sense to him, and he became a Jew in 1971. Eventually, he was ordained as a rabbi because it fit his personality and his inquisitive mind.
Judaism allows a person to be as intellectual as they can possibly be and still hold on to all the faith in the world. You do not have to give up your faith to be a good Jew. You do not have to give up your intellect to be a good Jew. They coexist within the Jew. Other faiths don't necessarily allow that. So why Judaism? You can question God.
Yahweh. In a way, the spiritual development of Rabbi Fineh and the whole synagogue mirrors the history of activism in the black community, from civil rights to identity politics to personal growth. He sees the world in shades of gray. It's not about original sin or being saved. There's no heaven or hell. Judaism provides a set of rules that governs daily life. The rituals remind people that God is watching them. And Jewish law helps them wrestle with moral choices, both big and small.
That's the wrestling inside of every human being that has to go on. And Judaism allows those dichotomies and those tensions to exist in us. And it's okay. It's okay.
That message resonates. Membership has soared. And he's bringing the congregation back to the homeland, Africa. Temple Beth Shalom is working with several congregations in Uganda. Unlike the Ethiopian Jews, this group has had very little contact with the outside Jewish world until now.
And one group of leaders said to me, my last visit in September, Rabbi, please, if we join and you become our spiritual leader, please tell me that we can still drum and dance. I said I wouldn't have it any other way.
At Temple Beth Shalom, even white Jews are coming through the door. But these are mostly Reform Jews from the liberal wing of Judaism. The Orthodox refuse to recognize Hebrew Israelites. And some of the black Jews who practice by the book aren't sure what to make of these visitors. The rabbi hopes to bridge the gap and let both sides know that they should feel right at home with each other.
Seeing the Jew that looks different than we look, than I look, when she opens her mouth, and out of her mouth comes the same exact Amida, Shemona Esrei. The pronunciation may be a little different, but the words are the same. Then, that's a Jew.
In Chicago, I'm Eric Molinsky for Weekend America.
A version of this piece was originally produced for nextbook.org. That's a Jewish cultural website. You can worship along with the congregation Temple Beth Shalom. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
All over the country, Jews are opening the Seder to other faiths. There's an interfaith Seder in Santa Barbara next weekend that will include Baha'is, Buddhists, Christians, Hindus, and Muslims, as well as Jews sharing the Passover meal.
The Jewish Federation of Greater Buffalo just had its 19th Interfaith Seder. They say it's one of the largest in the country. A highlight was a sing-along of the spiritual Go Down Moses. That's a song that resonates with both Jewish and African-American history. You're listening to Weekend America.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
Coming up, he turned blood into blossoms, into art. His work is on display this weekend. Stick around and meet Epi Lopez on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Week in America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. It's time for your letters.
2 weeks ago, we brought you a story about James Brown helping to save the city of Boston from riots the night after Martin Luther King was assassinated. And a lot of you wrote in with your memories of that time, including Ted Milmackey, who listens to us on WBUR in Boston.
I was a member of the Massachusetts Air National Guard that night. We were activated and called to the base, told to prepare for riot duty. When the Army Guard showed up with trucks and rifles, we were convinced that things were escalating and we might actually be put on the streets. Fortunately, the James Brown concert at Boston Garden kicked in. The riots never materialized, and we never left the airport. We found a little black and white TV set and spent the night watching James Brown. As I recall, they replayed the concert several times that night, and I never got tired of hearing "Papa's Got a Brand New Bag" over and over again.
Last week, we ran a story about a man who decided to use an organization to find a wife in Thailand. Some listeners said, good for him. He should do whatever makes him happy.
Well, others saw issues of racism and exploitation in the idea that a Western man would seek a wife in Southeast Asia. Priya Raghubir teaches at the University of California, Berkeley's Business School, and she's written about cultural differences in expectations of marriage. Professor Raghubir, is marriage tourism the same as sexual tourism?
I think there's a world of difference. I think marriage tourism is where people are looking for a soulmate, and they could be searching either in their own locality or another country, whereas sex tourism is where you go to another place just to have sex.
Well, how does the American view of marriage color how we look at marriage tourism?
Well, I think the American view of marriage is highly romanticized. A lot of people here believe you marry a soulmate, and I think that's a very idealized view of marriage. Increasingly, people are finding that, you know, just a companion, somebody to have dinner with, take a walk with, might fit the bill just as well for a long-time partnership, and therefore you don't necessarily need to be looking for soulmate material when you get married, but just a person who shares a similar set of values.
Okay, so you're saying that Americans have this very optimal view, romantic view of what marriage and a soulmate is. Now, how does that color how we then look at marriage tourism?
I think the way it colors it is that people think that, well, clearly you're not going to be able to go to another country and in a few weeks find your ideal soulmate life partner. Therefore, well, maybe they're going there for the sex.
I know that not all countries that have marriage tourism also have arranged marriages, but I'm wondering if there's some parallels. Are some of the spouses who are looking at marriage tourism from maybe the Asian countries, are they also bringing this idea of I'm trying to make an arrangement, this more practical idea rather than this romantic idea about marriage?
I think there's a great parallel there for a variety of reasons. I think the primary one is the expectations that both parties bring into the marriage, and the expectation is that this is an arrangement for companionship and stability.
And so are the partners, the potential marriage partners outside of the United States, what is their view of marriage tourism?
Coming from Asia as I do, I can see that the women, typically women in those countries, would want to look for opportunities which may be different from the ones offered in their own countries in terms of the quality of a marriage, in terms of the quality of a relationship, as well as in terms of the quality of a social as well as economic life. So I think there are routes for women to find a fulfilling relationship of a type which may be different than the options they have available in their current social set.
Well, Priya, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, Desiree.
We love receiving your letters, comments, and suggestions. Talk to us. Come to our website, weekendamerica.org. Thank you.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. In New Orleans this weekend, the Sidearm Gallery is displaying the drawings of artist Epifanio Lopez. This is Epi's first ever art show. He fine-tuned his skills, not in art school, but during the 14 years he spent in prison after getting convicted of hauling 400 pounds of marijuana from Mexico to Louisiana. Reporter David Weinberg brings us Epi's story from New Orleans.
At nearly 6 feet and over 300 pounds, with a shaved head and a goatee, Epi would fit the image of a Mexican drug smuggler perfectly if it weren't for one thing, the old lady reading glasses he wears. He blames his poor eyesight on years of trying to draw at night in prison.
One time I was drawing, sitting on my rack. Rack is your bunk, they call them racks. And right in front of me, there was an area where everybody would come to fight. That's where you fight, in the back of the dorm where the cameras won't see you. And this guy got hit, and blood splattered, and it splattered on my drawing. And right where the blood spilled on, I drew little bitty flowers like they were falling from the sky, you know.
Epi grew up in the small border town of Edinburgh, Texas.
I was adopted by an aunt and uncle. And my uncle, coolest guy in the whole wide world, died when I was 9. So I kind of like, you know, my adopted mother was very lenient, maybe. I was spoiled, you know, did what I wanted.
Epi says he started getting into trouble, but he still managed to graduate and go to a local community college where he studied printmaking. And he was doing well, getting good grades. Then, while he was in school, his adopted mother died.
So I had to end up eventually having to drop out to probate her will, you know. By the time I probated her will and sold her house and paid all her debts off, dude, there was no money left.
Epi says he bought a pound of Mexican weed for $75 and took a bus to New Orleans, where he sold it for $1,000.
I started coming back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Before you know it, I started having to use 18-wheelers and trucks or whatever, stay in fancy hotels, and it was fun. It was fun while it lasted.
Epi says he eventually went to prison on drug charges. When he was released in 2006, he got a job working as a janitor for a group of local artists who were building a theater out of a shed in their backyard. One day, Epi was sweeping up, and he overheard the producers talking.
They were talking about looking for some more performers and stuff, you know, and they needed a guy to play the part of a Mexican drug dealer. And I'm like, man, I should be able to play that part pretty well, you know, I'm so well rehearsed, you know. So they let me try for it, and it was great, man. It was a sold-out show. I was like a local celebrity for a while.
A local gallery owner saw Epi's performance and asked to see his art. Epi's work is a collection of drawings done in pen. Each individual drawing is made up of thousands of tiny black lines with the occasional touch of red ink. Many of the drawings look like tattoos you would see in prison, hearts with names, daggers, naked ladies. In fact, a lot of his drawings were designed as tattoos for other prisoners. But some of Epi's best work, the thing he drew most in prison, was flowers.
Because they're all for women, you know, missing you, loving you, happy birthday, thinking of you, and all that. The main source of my income in prison was making cards.
When Epi left prison, he says his only possession was a tattered black notebook full of drawings.
This one here is a cross, but this paper is the back page of a Bible. See how it looks old, aged? And this girl here, she's sitting on this rock. She's hot, huh? Very voluptuous. You see how she's holding her head, leaning back, and she's saying, oh, God, why don't you please let Epi out? You know? She's missing me.
The originals from the notebook will go on display. The show will be Epi's first, but it's not the first opportunity he's had to display his art. When Epi was locked up, a warden asked him to paint a mural on the wall of the prison.
And I didn't want to draw in it. I didn't say why, you know, but I remember when I was a kid one time, this was maybe 17, and I'd gotten drunk and got thrown in jail. And the guy next to me could hear me scratching on the wall. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm writing my name on the wall. He goes, don't write your name on the wall, man, because you'll always stay here. Your name's going to be here, you know. It's like you being here, always, in prison. So I don't know, because of that, that stayed in my head all the time. I never would write my name anywhere. So I actually didn't want to do the mural for the prison because I felt that I would always stay there, and I wanted to get out.
The show this weekend will include models wearing tattoos of his designs. They will pose inside chalk outlines, and another of Epi's creations will also be served at the opening.
We're going to have homemade wine, like in prison, hooch. We were even thinking about buying a toilet and serving it out of a toilet, you know, like that's where you hide it in prison.
In New Orleans, I'm David Weinberg for Weekend America.
And you know, what's really striking is to see Epi and his art and listen to him talk about it at the same time. We have a great multimedia slideshow that we'd love for you to visit at weekendamerica.org.
Thanks for sharing your weekend with us. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Grilled cheese means melted American cheese and grilled white bread, right? Well, not at the National Grilled Cheese Invitational. Today, 140 chefs are gathering at LA's Griffith Park. They're competing for the title of Grilled Cheese Champion. The categories are, well, I can't really say them on the air, but let's just call them hot. They are really hot. In fact, they're so hot that this year they've banned the use of flamethrowers. Yeah, it's that fierce. Rico Galliano brings us a story from a past competition.
Linda Williamson is a mother of two, but more importantly, she's the winner of the first ever Grilled Cheese Invitational. In her kitchen, she struggles to devise another champion recipe. She knows only it will involve broiled squash.
Maybe I should find some way to integrate burnt cheese into the sandwich.
And you could call it, like, the burnt sandwich.
No, I will not change the name of my sandwich.
Which is, once again?
The Gorgonzola Mind Controller. It's a hyper cheese brain freeze.
It is also, to Linda, an instrument of revenge. See, at the previous year's Invitational, she partnered with her friend, Casey.
And we thought we had a surefire winner.
And what happened?
We were robbed.
The event's creator, Tim Walker, admits the problem wasn't the sandwich. It was the judges.
The sandwich used mascarpone. To the untrained palate, it tastes like whipped cream. And a lot of people didn't think there was any cheese in the sandwich. The other thing was the person who actually ended up winning for the category was my boyfriend.
Boyfriend Gallagher Lawson, with a sandwich that hit your face like a ton of delicious bricks. And it undeniably had cheese in it.
Are you a little worried that maybe this year emotions are going to be running a little high and something could go down?
I believe so, but that's why we're going to provide alcohol.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second annual Grilled Cheese Invitational. Let the grilling commence!
My name is Holly Rose Larson, and I am cooking a sandwich entitled Lick It, white country potato bread, Kraft American singles, and Hershey's chocolate syrup.
My name is Mayor Jim. I'm working here with Tigger. We are recreating Christo's Gates in grilled cheese.
Okay, tell us what's about to happen.
This guy is about to eat a sandwich with ground up light bulbs in it. I don't get it.
I'm Dr. Tano today. I'm a celebrity judge.
What's in the lead right now?
The cheese's crust was really good. Nothing too fancy about it. It was cut into a cross.
The big throwdown of the night between Linda Williamson and Gallagher Lawson. Do you have a feeling about one or the other?
Gallagher's looked good. It looked like a thick crust. I'm interested to see if he makes it work.
Gallagher Lawson?
Yes.
So have you had a chance to go over to Linda's stable?
I haven't been able to go over there, and I don't plan to. I'm staying away from her.
Oh, there goes Gallagher. Well, I've certainly upstaged him in the sartorial department already.
What are you wearing tonight?
A Velveeta orange silk skirt topped with a blouse featuring the colors of broiled squash and grilled cheese.
I've also been handed a grilled cheese haiku, and it goes like this. Hot cheesy goodness, hot cheesy goodness, hot cheesy goodness. Thank you.
To you, what does the Grilled Cheese Invitational mean?
It means normal people taking something mundane and making it into art.
I think a lot of people have that innate childhood attachment to the grilled cheese, something they didn't get from their mother, a grilled cheese that they really wanted when they were very young they didn't get. I think we've seen the kind of damage that can do. It leads to things like this.
Hours pass. Hundreds of onlookers consume wave after wave of cheese. After her turn at the grill, Linda stands in a corner looking spent.
My hands were shaking as I was putting the sandwiches off the spatula, yeah.
And finally, Tim Walker, scotch in hand, doles out the final award.
And in first place, we have Dor Nathan and Sandor Sonnen, the Monty Cheese Bowl!
So it's over for another year. I did get an honorable mention, which is better than nothing. Earlier in the evening, it was probably a combination of nerves and having my hands full. I didn't eat very much, and I was actually hungry, and I proceeded to make myself a grilled cheese sandwich. And Tano, the judge, who had eaten 40 grilled cheese sandwiches, joined me, and I split one with him. If there is one person who can truly be called a grilled cheese champion, it's got to be him.
What happens to a person after he samples that much grilled cheese?
He wants more.
In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Weekend America.
This year, they not only banned the flamethrowers, they've also axed the alcohol. Well, milk goes better with grilled cheese anyway. There's two award-winning recipes for grilled cheese at our website, weekendamerica.org, and you can also see video highlights from last year's competition.
Weather for this weekend's Grilled Cheese Invitational in L.A.? Well, you can't fry an egg on the sidewalk. Highs only in the low 60s. Here is a slightly fuller look at weekend weather with John Moe.
Whether you love leafy greens or just have an urgent need to punch out Bluto, you'll want to be in Alma, Arkansas. Sun and 75 degrees for the Spinach Festival with car show, music, and food vendors. On second thought, do you really want to eat a vegetable that screws up your face like that and makes your forearms all bloated and gross? Halloween is months away, but Baltimore wants to play dress-up now. So the Fells Point neighborhood, deep in maritime tradition, has a War of 1812 recreation held under clouds and 77 degrees. You can dress up as a pirate, wench, sailmaker, merchant, sailor, barkeep, or homemaker, which means everyone will dress up as a pirate or a wench. Just because people live in Kentucky doesn't mean you can call them hillbillies. Unless it's Pikeville, Kentucky, in which case, yeah, go ahead and call them hillbillies. The Hillbilly Festival has parade, dance contest, thunder in 72, and a cornhole tournament. It's sponsored by a Mr. Clampett. It seems one day he was shooting at some food, went up through the ground. Well, it's a long story. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
This Earth Day weekend, support a farmer by setting his fields on fire. Coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. If you can't figure out what to do to celebrate Earth Day this weekend, why not set a few fields on fire? A Kansas rancher is charging people to do just that. This past weekend was the yearly Flames in the Flint Hills event in Emporia, Kansas, prairie country. We asked Sylvia Maria Gross to check it out for us.
For most of his career, Jan Jansen was a college administrator.
But don't hold that against me. I've always been an outdoors kid at heart and gave things names, trees and weeds and bushes, even when I didn't know what they were.
Jan grew up in a small town in western Kansas, and when he retired from academia, he bought a cattle ranch in the nearby Flint Hills. It's a region with the largest swath of original tallgrass prairie in the country. For thousands of years, animals have grazed on its natural grasses and wildflowers. Every few years, a lightning strike would burn the pastures down to ashes. It's an ecosystem that Native Americans and then modern ranchers like Jan have learned to help along with cattle and fire.
If we didn't burn and graze this area, it would become primarily a scrub forest, mainly with eastern red cedars that don't have much value for anything.
The controlled burns release nutrients that help the grass to grow: earth, wind, fire.
Here's where you check in, folks, right here.
We have to check in. Okay, yeah. Thank you. Better? Before check in.
When it was time to burn, Jan used to just call over some friends, get some six-packs, and make a little party of it. But then friends would invite more friends. People from out of town would hear about it and start scheduling vacations around Jan's prairie burn. Some even started offering to pay. So Jan created this event called Flames in the Flint Hills. Guests pay $120 each to help him burn his prairie. Anne Montilla brought her husband and four children. They're from Paris originally. Now they live in Kansas City.
We talked to our friends, American friends, in Kansas City, and they say, why are you going to do, you are going, burning what? Burning what? But nobody does that. I say, okay, but we are going to do it.
There are 50 paying guests today, plus a bluegrass band, a caterer who serves local cheese curd, and peach-glazed buffalo and barley meatballs out of a chuck wagon.
All the guests, please come inside.
In the barn, Jan steps on a little stage, and the guests sit on blocks of hay. He gives them a little history, science, and then some fire safety tips.
It's important to me that everybody that came with hair and eyebrows leaves with the same amount of hair and eyebrows.
Jan's rule of thumb is to remember the colors black and blue. If the fire's heading at you, he says, go to an area that's black because it's already been burned.
If you can't get to someplace black, and here it comes, go someplace blue. Like a pond.
And with that, we're ready to set some fires.
As you file out, grab some matches if you want them. Go get your rake and follow me across the pond.
We line up along one edge of the pasture. Our backs are to the wind. Jan tells us to pull the tall, dry Indian grass into little clumps for kindling. And then the big moment.
Fire lighters, are you ready? Light the fire!
It's windy, and the grass takes a few seconds to catch.
We've got smoke. Right. Drag to your left.
But when it does, the firelighters use their rakes to drag it along the ground until it whooshes up into huge flames. In a minute or two, it's a true inferno. Licking the sky, 20 feet up, hotter and brighter than I expected. Now, some people here are old hands at this. Brian Keith is a local rancher. He's helping Jan out as a volunteer and admits some locals think this is a little weird.
The older generation really do think it's awkward or odd that somebody would come pay for an experience like this, but I think it's a great opportunity for them, and you know, it's also an opportunity for Jan to, you know, create a little income and educate the public at the same time.
There are people who criticize these burns. They say the smoke hurts air quality. It's a debate that's gone on for decades. But Jan says prairie burns are essential to ranching, and he hopes these events will teach people where their food comes from. And he also wants to show struggling farmers and ranchers other ways to make money off the land.
The ranching way of life, the horses, the cattle, the four-wheelers, the tractors, the combines, most all of which these days have an extra seat in them.
And that extra seat could be worth $100 to have a tourist ride along, see what it's like to harvest corn or wheat. It's almost night, and 4-year-old Zita de Montilla is a little frustrated. Her fire is taking a little longer to flame up.
It's not like that one.
Yours is a slow burn.
Yeah.
It'll get there.
And in about 7 days, it'll all be green.
Green
one with flowers and flowers and flowers.
Mm-hmm. I fell into a burning ring of fire.
No burning songs now.
We're getting a little giddy, surrounded by lines of flame and walking over the charred ground in between. As people are leaving, Jan still has work to do. He pulls up to the smoldering field in his four-wheeler with a Miller Lite in his hand.
I'm celebrating.
But he's not done yet.
I see the possibility of some fence posts that might be on fire, so I'm going to go down and put out the fence posts.
I'll let you do that.
For Weekend America, I'm Sylvia Maria Gross in the Flint Hills of Kansas.
To see photos of the prairie burn, check out our website, weekendamerica.org. You know, listening to this, Bill, our family spends a fair amount of time in the countryside in Ontario, and we saw a controlled burn there once, and we were completely mesmerized. But mm-hmm. we had sense enough to stay in our car with the engine running in case the uncontrolled burn started happening out of the controlled burn. I mean,
you wanted to save your eyebrows and hair.
Exactly. Actually lighting the fire? I don't think so. Uh-huh. We're a bunch of chickens.
Yeah, some might call this burn glorified pyromania. Some might call it painting Tom Sawyer's fence. But agritourism is small but growing. The USDA says in 2004 about 3% of all farms made money from things like wine roots and hay rides and apple picking and maple syrup harvesting. And even, intriguingly, people will clean up after farm animals and pay for the privilege.
Whoa.
And, yeah, as the reporter said, it does get you close to the land. That's another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Don't forget, this weekend is the National Grilled Cheese Invitational in Los Angeles.
And then on the inside, you put a thin coat of cream cheese and then a slice of American cheese and grill it on both sides. It's very delicious.
You can download a free podcast of our entire show at weekendamerica.org.
For those who celebrate it, happy Passover. It's the weekend. Enjoy!
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul. And made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
When you think weekend in a Las Vegas gated community, what comes to mind? Swimming pools, palatial estates, neighbors outside socializing. But what about during a foreclosure crisis?
The break-ins, the busted windows, the mysterious neighbors across the street who don't speak, the broken-down cars.
On the next Weekend America, a foreclosure crisis hits the capital of America's weekend, Las Vegas. Join us.